Hello and welcome to Nolan Me, Nolan You, a limited series podcast that celebrates the work of writer-director Christopher Nolan. I'm your host, Emily Murray, and today I'm joined by film journalist and editor Simon Brew to discuss Nolan's sci-fi epic Interstellar. The film follows a group of explorers as they travel through a wormhole in space on a mission to ensure the survival of humanity. We discuss the science of the movie, the central father and daughter relationship, the aesthetics of the different planets, and much more. But first, here's a clip.
Wreckage. Where's the rest?
Where's the mountains?
Those aren't mountains. They're waves.
What? Oh, shit. Oh, shit.
That one's moving away from us.
We need the recorder.
Brand Doyle, back to the Ranger now.
We're not leaving without her data.
Get back here now. We do not have time. The second wave is coming. We're in the middle of a swell.
Welcome, Simon, to Nolan Me, Nolan You.
Hello.
How are you today?
I have rehearsed. I am prepared. I am conscious of the fact that in your run of Nolan films, you've invited me to do the difficult one.
I have.
So I'm basically trying my damnedest to sound vaguely intelligent about what is not always an easy film to talk about. So did I put enough disclaimer in there in case I muff this up?
I'm sure you won't muck it up, though. You are Mr. Simon Brewer at the end of the day.
Nothing could go wrong.
So just want to tell us just a quick bit about yourself and also your introduction to the films of Christopher Nolan.
Okay, well, I'm a boring old nerd. It's true. I founded a website called Den of Geek in 2007. I left that in 2018. I've started Film Stories in 2018, which is two different print magazines, a podcast, a website, and other live events once upon a time. Who remembers those? I've just found an assortment of outlets by which to bore people about films. In terms of my introduction to Christopher Nolan, I was thinking about this because I used to import loads of Region 1 DVDs back in the day.
Okay.
That's one for the kids. And so it must have been Memento. And I remember distinctly with Memento, and then I picked up Following after that, that there was someone on a forum called DVD Talk gave you all the chapter references if you wanted to watch the entire film in the right order.
Okay.
So that was the first time I'd known anyone really particularly dissect a DVD to quite that level. The first one, I struggled with Memento the first time I saw it as well. Is that blasphemy to say on this podcast?
No, it's fine.
And it's okay. And it's only going back to it really that I found the appreciation for it. I was like that with Seven as well. Mm. I mean, there's a couple of films that first time round I just like, okay. And then I had another look. I was just like, no, it's me that's the problem.
That's me with The Social Network. I didn't get it on first watch, but I returned to it and I was like, actually, this is a masterpiece. What? It's me. It's me who's the problem, as you said.
It's odd you should bring The Social Network up.
Okay.
Because I had an idea. Because you've obviously got an immense love for the work of Christopher Nolan.
Yes.
And of puns based around ABBA songs.
Yes, yes, yes.
So how about The Fincher Takes It All?
Oh, that's good.
Like the next, so, you know, I've got a whole list of these once I've run out of things to talk about on Interstellar. But The Fincher Takes It All, and then you can do, I'll come back to The Social Network for that. But if you want to write that down, you have it. The first one I think I remember was Insomnia. But Insomnia was, Memento, I was really struggling just to grasp actually watching it for the first time. But I remember Insomnia was that run of films that Robin Williams did where he was playing darker roles.
Yes, yeah.
And that was a lot of the press attention around Insomnia. It wasn't around the fact it was Christopher Nolan. It was the fact that, hang on, here's Robin Williams doing another really creepy, unsettling piece of film work, which he was exceptionally good at. So those were my Nolan introductions, which I don't think I've given you a specific answer there, which I'm really quite proud of.
Well, he's not one for specific answers either, is he, as a filmmaker?
Yes. I see where you're segue, which film you're segueing towards here. My life, he digs out his encyclopedia.
It's yes, I did get you on for the not only the longest one in his filmography, but also perhaps
yes,
the most difficult, the most divisive, and the most difficult one to talk about. So
It's divisive. It's not divisive up until about half an hour to go, I don't think.
Then it gets weird.
Up until that point. And then it really does get weird. Where are we on spoilers? Are we allowed to do spoilers?
We're allowed to do spoilers because I'd hope that people listen have seen Interstellar. I would hope. If not, watch Interstellar and then listen to this.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you're the boss. I will do as I'm told. So, I mean, tell me where you want to start because I've got no idea.
I suppose your first watch, what was your reaction when you went in and you came out after 3 hours in the cinema watching some hard sci-fi action?
My first reaction was, I really need a wee, which is pretty much the same of any film of that length. My first reaction to it was not dissimilar to most people's first reaction to it, I think. Now, I'd been attending New York Comic Con a month or two before it came out. I remember the film was plastered. The billboard was outside the convention center in New York. And even though it wasn't one of the movies being actively showcased there, that was the audience. There was no question at all that this was being aimed at the broadest possible audience. Mm. And it was really incredible once I'd seen the film that it was doing that. And that's no disrespect to that audience, but I think Interstellar, there's been some wonderful stuff written about the marketing of Christopher Nolan films, but the whole way it was pushed as really a big Friday night sci-fi film, wasn't it? There was no clue, if you walked in not knowing what you were getting, and I really loved it for that. And so for 2 hours 20 minutes, I was absolutely gripped. And I mean, wears its influences on its sleeve, that much is clear, but also it's very much its own thing. And I just felt that someone had got this through the Hollywood system, a big, huge, intelligent science fiction film where, again, I didn't know where it was going, where there really was a set. I mean, the whole setup of they go off to explore the three planets. I wanted to go and see the three planets. I mean, I just thought that this has been set up in such an interesting way and such a clever way as well. And so I remember being really, 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 really gripped by it, and then it started explaining things. Then it's got to that point towards the end where Matthew McConaughey does his moment of sacrifice and the explaining begins, and I just sat there and just sat. Every now and then I sit and watch a film and I make the assumption that I'm the one who's not clever. Do you know what I mean? It's just like when you're seeing something and you're just like watching it, and you just like, it must be me. I must be the problem here, because Nolan is brilliant. I mean, unquestionably brilliant. And I just wasn't gelling with the direction that the film went for its last. It's not even the last act, really, is it? It is like the last 20, 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And I walked out puzzled. I walked out thinking that it had asked an awful lot of incredibly interesting questions, and it had, it's not that it fudged the answer, it's just like it was asking questions that it couldn't answer really, but it tried to answer. It was like me doing GCSE maths or something like that, in the, you know, you get a tick sometimes for showing you're working, but you don't necessarily get the tick if you don't come back at the final answer. So I walked out baffled. And I can't sit here and pretend I walked out thinking I'd seen a flat out masterpiece. I thought I'd seen one of the most courageous, interesting big studio movies of that year. And I still stick to that. And yeah, I mean, it's a very long answer again to just say, just like, WTF, really. What was yours?
I went by myself to go see it at the IMAX. I wasn't studying at Leeds Uni, so I went to go to Bradford to go to. They have like an IMAX cinema.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, it's
is
great.
It the science, the museum, some sort of museum, which is a really good.
It is a museum, Emily. Yeah.
It was like 11 a.m. There wasn't anyone there, and even though it was opening day, I think it's because I like went on like a Friday morning, and yeah. I was really blown away. Like I cried, I think, for the whole train journey home.
Okay.
I think I was baffled by the science, but I was more hit by the emotional story of the dad's relationship with Murph. So Cooper and Murph's relationship and that whole ending scene. And like I watched it again this week, and I was still crying for like a good 45 minutes after the film rolled. But I do admit it took me a second watch. I went to see it again that weekend to really like get to grips with the scientific ideas. But for me, even though there's all this like hard science going on, it really is like, in terms of my connection to the movie, it's a story of, you know, this dad and his relationship with his daughter Murph, and which is why I find the whole debate of is Christopher Nolan a cold filmmaker interesting, because that's something personally I've never found, particularly when it comes to Interstellar.
Okay. I mean, the whole issue about whether he's cold or not, I don't see coldness. I see humanity at the heart of an awful lot of his films. The emotional connection, I very much get that. My complaint first time watching it really is the explaining is so intensive. I just felt it wasn't that. It was just a distraction from it. To a degree, that it just it took me a little bit away from that. But again, my head might be wired that way, that it was just I really desperately wanted to understand what he was doing. And one of the most telling things I think of Interstellar, because I was talking to you about this beforehand, is that the incessant articles, and I've commissioned a few in my time, that the internet loves throwing up of explaining the ending of. You know the ones?
And
you see them for everything. Explaining the ending of the Angry Birds movie too, you know, something like that. But in the case of Interstellar, there's precisely the kind of film of which such articles are useful, I think. Yes. I throw Annihilation into that mix as well.
And I love Annihilation.
I love Annihilation. Mm. And a former colleague of mine, a man called Ryan Lambie, wrote a piece back in our Den of Geek days where he threw a completely different perspective on Annihilation for me, about the whole thing as a metaphor to depression. And I just was astounded by it, and it really enriched the film. And I went off ahead of knowing we were going to have this chat and knowing I was going to be thoroughly tested on my Interstellar knowledge, to read one of the articles on explaining the ending of it. And I went back over, I've watched the ending again twice building up to this, which kind of tells you a little bit as well. And I read a really, really good piece, and I barely saw an ounce of fat on it, because Google algorithms are such that you're now directed, you have to write at least 500 words, otherwise no one will look at it. That's why you get so much guff, really. but I read this, and it went in detail through the ending and explaining it all. I just thought, oh, that's good. And I thought, I've been reading this a long time. And so I just did a word count on that one article of explaining the ending of Interstellar. And again, I come back to the point where there wasn't an awful lot of fat on this article. It's 4,000 words. 4,000 words.
That's eight
pages of a magazine to dissect the ending of a film. And I think, I don't think there's much question, really, that Interstellar is a two-watch movie. Which is difficult given the length of the film. That if you don't go back for a second look at it, you're missing a lot. Now, appreciating some people are much cleverer than me and will just click into it straight away. But I just think there's such a cauldron of ideas and emotions in there that the second look is pretty important. Yeah. Not least because of the bits that ending refers to. Earlier in the film, how that ending is seeded throughout the film, quite cleverly, really. And whether or not you buy the ending or not, which ultimately I do now, there is an awful lot of building work towards it throughout the movie.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, I think, like, after my first watch, I knew that I adored it and I felt it was a masterpiece. But in terms of actually getting to grips with everything going on, because there's a lot going on, which is no surprise considering it's 3 hours long, like it took a second watch. One of my favorite watches of Interstellar, because I have seen it quite a few times,
okay,
I went to Manchester, has a science festival, and they had a screening of it with a panel of black hole experts, which was fascinating. So to have you have a discussion at the start about the science and then watch the film and then at the end have these experts, you know, discuss the science of it, like, it was just opened up my eyes even wider, I suppose, to what was going on. And I suppose also, like, I know a lot of people don't like Interstellar, but I suppose it depends on how you like your sci-fi. Like, I've always preferred sci-fi to be quite, not dry, but a bit more real, a bit more, like, hard, a bit more less, like, Star Wars, fantastical, virtual, like Star Wars. But I need it, I suppose, more grounded in the real world. And that's what I also really like about Interstellar. Like, it's, like, a vision of the future in terms of our plants dying and stuff that feels real, and everything about it, yeah, it just feels so real. And that's also what appeals to me.
Well, all those videos are real, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know, yeah, which is incredible. So we're talking about the videos as they go through the house, and the interviews that have been done about the damage being done to the planet. And Nolan, I think it's only Ellen Burstyn's, I think, is specially recorded for the film. And the rest of them, I think it's from a Ken Burns TV documentary series, isn't it?
I think so, maybe. And
they are talking genuinely about the state of the planet. It's just so pressing. He puts it in. One of the interesting, you talk about the hard science of it. I mean, we should have a chat about the film Ad Astra at some point if we're going to do hard science. But one of the interesting things about the way Interstellar was promoted, because I was doing Den of Geek back then, and they were talking, and we were offered all sorts of opportunities. But Warner Brothers put up, as well as all the standard, do you want to interview so-and-so, the theoretical physicist Kip Thorne.
He had a lot to do with the story, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, he was integral to the science of the film, but also I thought it was really interesting that he was integral to one level of the promotion of the film. That for me, saying before about they're blanketing this at things like Comic-Con and stuff like that, they were engaging with a slightly deeper sci-fi. And again, that's no slight on a Comic-Con community, but they were looking to engage on a, you know, quite a dense scientific level, to the point where to websites and magazines who are perhaps more used to being offered clickbaity things, here we are being offered theoretical articles on wormholes and stuff like that. And again, I don't think I've seen that on a big studio movie before or since.
I'm trying to rack my brain and I can't think of any of
Geostorm might have done.
Geostorm. Yeah, Simon, if you get Simon Brew on a podcast, he will mention Geostorm.
I'm sure there's a sort of Costner film that could fit in. take a chance on Scorsese. Take a chance on me. Would that work?
Yes.
That's a little bit clunky. I still think that because of Peter Jackson's films going on for quite a while, Jack's On and On and On. Oh. That's an ABBA song, isn't it?
Yes.
No, see, you're not impressed.
No, it's not that. It's because I'm not impressed by Peter Jackson's movies.
Where are you on Danny Boyle?
Danny Boyle is one of my favourites.
Oh, well, Danny. That's Danny, money, isn't it?
That's a good one.
Did you like the two popes?
I was mixed on the two popes.
Were you? Okay, where were you on Constant Gardener? Because I haven't seen Constant Gardener. Oh, no, that's great. But directed by Fernando Ferrero Morales, so obviously Fernando. Did you see the films Fernando? Do you want to write these down?
I am writing them down. Well, also, I'm recording, so it's you.
Oh, fair dues. Sorry, I've taken you criminally away from the subject of Interstellar there.
That's but for terrible. Good reason, for ABBA podcasts.
For bad puns. The promotion of the film, I did talk about that just before. There was, I'm not sure I'm allowed to talk about this. So, I mean, do lots of people listen to this? If you do, it's just like, it's got to be a bit of a secret. There was a really awkward moment at the UK press conference.
Okay.
Where someone asked a question, and there's Nolan, Anne Hathaway, Matthew McConaughey, they're all in a line. Someone asked a question as to how difficult one of the people on that panel was to work with. And just blatantly, just like, I hear this person is really difficult to work with. What would you say to that? And you just like, what? A friend of mine was in the room. In fact, a friend of mine was also doing the PR for it. And it's just like, it was a grand swallow up moment. And so what happens after press conferences is websites are offered the full feed if they want to host it on their site. If you're utterly nerdly inclined, as I clearly am not, if you find the streaming press conference, which is still online, there is a very awkward edit in the middle, and that was when one international journalist asked a very obnoxiously rude question one of that panel. Now, I've not mentioned...
Why did you do that?
I don't know. I've not mentioned the name of everyone on the panel either, to be clear, lest you think the clue is in the names that I've mentioned so far. But it was just like that. It was a jaw dropper, an absolute jaw dropper.
God, journalists.
Yeah. Journalists. Linda Obst, anyway, who's a movie producer, worked with Nora Ephron on loads of films, but she wrote a really good book. She's written a couple of really good books. And in her most recent, she talked to Sue Kroll, who was head of marketing at Warner Brothers, about how to promote a Christopher Nolan film. And there's a great big whole section on it, on how to promote a Christopher Nolan film. And you see this with Interstellar. I think it really started with Inception. In that they sell Christopher Nolan. They don't, if you go back to all the marketing for both Inception and to Interstellar, at no point in the one sheet, in the trailers, do they really try and explain what the films are about. And instead, if you look at the minutiae of those individual marketing campaigns, I thought it was fascinating. They sell Nolan as a movie star. And that is incredibly rare. I think it was most effective, actually, on Dunkirk. Because that was, I remember walking through Leicester Square in London, great big huge billboard towering over Leicester Square, and there's Christopher Nolan's name, as big as any movie star in that film. And he is the movie star of this. And I mean, clearly Interstellar would not have got made with any other filmmaker, even if they come up with exactly the same screenplay, even if they come up with exactly the same cast. Who else could have got that through the systems? I don't think Spielberg could. Because Spielberg around that time was struggling. He was struggling to get the money to make Lincoln. You know, he had to get it from an assortment of different pots. And Lincoln was going to be a HBO movie at one point because he was struggling to raise the budget. James Cameron possibly could.
The only director I can think of now would be Denis Villeneuve.
I don't think he could raise $200 million to make this off the... I wish he could.
Now he could after the success of Arrival and stuff, but not back then.
I don't even think he could now, and I say wishing he could, because Blade Runner 2049, as brilliant as it clearly is, was not a massive hit. I mean Arrival was profitable, but the difference with Nolan, the transformative bit with Nolan, was Inception. I don't think it was Batman, I think it was Inception. And to take Inception to what, 800 million worldwide, I mean, that's Marvel level. Yeah. And I don't think Denis Villeneuve and Dune hopefully will be a huge success, because I would love him to have the autonomy to make the films that he wants to make. That's the kind of level that only Nolan and Cameron are touching. I think Spielberg's most lucrative film is Crystal Skull, isn't it? And I don't think that's anywhere near the level that Inception got to. I mean, this is the size of the playing field he has built for himself. And I don't think that any film he's made has more explored that than Interstellar. See how I actually brought that back to the point?
That was very nicely done. Very nicely done.
Thank you. The sleight of hand there.
Yeah, well, talk about sleight of hand, that's exactly what I suppose Nolan's movies are about as well, isn't it?
Well, the clues are there, aren't they? But it's the old Sherlock Holmes thing. A lot of it is hidden in plain sight. And in Interstellar, I mean, inevitably the conversation, I keep coming back to the ending of it, but the clues for where it's going are in plain sight. Much of what he's doing, I mean, he's not hiding it per se. It's just, you just don't particularly... It's still unexpected when he gets there in the case of this film. I think there's a kind of parallel with The Prestige there. It's just like, how are you going to wrap that up? It's just like, oh, you're going to wrap it up that way. That's interesting. But it's worth, too, I think, just considering how the first 2 hours of the film is as well, because I'm pretty sure I'm waffling on about the back end of it. But that first 2 hours, the setup is extraordinary. And then they're going into space. That first bit where they come back on and so much time has passed.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Yeah, when they come back, and has it been 23 years, 27 years? Yeah. And it just really has. It's such like a packs a punch moment.
Yeah, and it's a very simple way of explaining the science.
Yes,
as well. That you can, I mean, Back to the Future Part 2, there's a moment in that where it's getting so tricky to explain that Doc Brown brings out a board and starts writing and starts mapping out the twin timelines and stuff like that. Nolan, it's so succinct in Interstellar, what he talks about with the passage of time. And you know about the Hans Zimmer clues woven into the score for that bit.
Yes. Yes.
That, I mean, it's when they, it's not, it's the water planet, isn't it? He says the first planet, and it's every second and a half there's a beat in the music, and that second and a half is a day in human terms that's passed. You're just like, jeepers whips. It reminds me of watching Inspector Morse as a kid, and the old thing that Barrington Fehlong in the music at the start was always said to have given away the name of the killer in Morse code, which I could never decipher, but that was always the story. But there it is, the clue. That moment is devastating. I think it's absolutely devastating. And I think one of the things he plays with extraordinarily in the film is time. And there's a moment as it builds to the ending where they have to reconcile that if they do this thing that will take them a few seconds to do, that's 51 years of their life. Mm-hmm. It's 51, I think, isn't it? 51 years of their life, and the ramifications of losing that amount of time and the human beings you will never see as a consequence of that. And it's all set up, but it's those shifts of time that are happening just before our eyes that I just find are really, I mean, they're just the earthquakes in the film, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. Well, Nolan's, of course, always been fascinated with time. It's basically his thing, isn't it? But I think you're right. I think the passage of time in Interstellar is just, it is such a moment when they come back.
Yes.
And it's like, how many years has it been? And then, obviously, the now iconic gif and meme of Matthew McConaughey's Cooper watching the video messages from across the years, and you know, you hear all the stories about what happened to his kids. But I think it's also nice that we have time in a sense of, in terms of how Cooper obviously relates, you know, the code back to Murph, it's put into a watch, which I think is also incredible. It's all about time, but it always is.
Yeah, but how did you feel when they actually arrived on that first planet and it's covered in water? What was your response to that?
I didn't know where it was going to go, but I think my instant thought was like, oh dear, this doesn't look good. And then they find, you know, in the water, you know, the transmitter, and they continue to search for it. And then also the whole idea of like these gigantic waves, like it's just incredible. One of my favourite things actually about the movie, which is really, really boring, it's how this, in terms of cinematography, it's how every single planet has a completely different look.
So that's where I was going.
So you got really, really dry Earth, and then you got this planet surrounded by water, and then you got Dr. Man's planet. I also have to say Matt Damon in this movie, I always forget he's in it, but then as soon as he appears on screen,
evil,
I'm like,
Matt,
he
Damon
is so
evil,
good.
Evil Matt Damon.
He is. But I didn't see like that coming. But I really like how, you know, that planet's so cold, icy and dead, just like Dr. Man himself.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then obviously at the end, you've got the new, what do they call it? What's it called? Cooper Station.
That's it, yeah.
And which is like Earth, but as Matthew McConaughey says, it's not. It's clean.
It's Elysium. It's Elysium Earth. Did you see that? Neil Blomkamp's Elysium.
I did, but I tried to forget about that, Simon, because it wasn't very good.
I think there's some great, I don't think Elysium's an entirely successful film. I think there's some terrific ideas in it, and a huge look. But one of the things I thought when they landed on the water planet, and I grew up watching Doctor Who.
Okay.
Not the
so
posh
did
Doctor.
I, actually.
Yeah, but not the posh, not the posh Doctor Who you whippersnappers.
I presume posh Doctor Who's like David Tennant era.
Yeah, well, that'll do. Okay. And I love Doctor Who of all era, but I kind of was conditioned to the fact that if you're going to an alien planet, it was a quarry somewhere that they might have applied some filters to put a bit of colour, I don't know. But basically, you're watching some rocks, you're watching an abandoned quarry, and then it would cut to a BBC studio or something. When they land on that first planet and it is just covered with water, I felt I was on a different planet. And that's really rare, I find, with science fiction, because they'd show, Ad Astra does it well as well, I think. But I just like, this is an entirely different world, and I utterly believed it's an entirely different world. And I really love Rogue One, actually. I'm not a massive Star Wars person, but I think Star Wars Rogue One is terrific.
That's really interesting you say that, because that's exactly how I feel about Star Wars and Rogue One.
That's a whole different podcast. I need to come up with an ABBA pun for that. But
yes, you do.
The thing, if you remember, at the start of Rogue One, they jump between loads of different planets. And the only way they can get across they're on different planets is they keep having to put title cards up to explain they're on, we're now on this world, we're now on this world, they're now on this world. Interstellar doesn't have to do that, because the look of it is so wonderfully shot. As you said just before, you are in no doubt, each time you go to a different planet, you are on a different alien world.
Yes.
And it doesn't need a barrel load of text to explain that to you, not least because he's taking his time to get us to those worlds. And I think that scaffolding, I think is the buzzword at the moment. I think that's really important. Scaffolding. I keep hearing that in meetings now. That's a thing, isn't it? But because the work has been done and I arrived there, and straight away, it's like visually wildly different, and yet in a weird way relatable. And you come to something like, I don't know, Rise of Skywalker, when they've got the huge waves. There's a water world in that, isn't there? Not as good as Costner's water world, but there's a water world in that.
There's a Kevin Costner drop.
And it's just like, it's just like digital waves in that Star Wars film. It's just like, there's no peril in it, and straight away you drop into this one, it's just like, they are in the shit. They are really, really in the shit. And that's even before they've gone out, they've gone back up and realised they missed 20-odd Christmases. And I just think that visual look of the film is just incredible, in that it does so much of the heavy lifting that oftentimes we see the editing suite. It's just like, we'd better put a load of text there. And Interstellar frequently just doesn't need to do it.
No.
Yeah.
No.
And that's really hard. That's really hard.
I think cinematographer is, I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, Hoyt van Hoytema?
Yeah, it's, and this was
Wally
the one
Pfister.
Where, Wally Pfister had gone off to do the film with Johnny Depp. Yeah. And I remember reading a story, I think it came up in like Sood's Corner in Private Eye or something like that, about how they went and location scouted for that first planet. And Nolan just started wading into the water just without saying anything. Everyone just instinctively followed. And this interview came across in quite a pretentious kind of way. But I think the important thing I took out of that is they were clearly on board. You know, they were utterly linked up. They knew what they were doing. It is a beautiful film to look at. And you can do this with science fiction as well. And I mean, I've dropped Ad Astra's name in a couple of times, and mainly because I think that's an underrated film. And also, it abides by quite a few of the same principles of treating the audience with a degree of respect, which I think Interstellar, whichever way you think of where it goes, you can't say it doesn't do that.
No. Also, Ad Astra fits into the same category of sad dad in space, which is my personal favourite genre.
Well, one of my favourite films is Field of Dreams, and I've been reading a bit some pushback on that recently, in that Field of Dreams is, again, as spoiler light as possible, to do with a man who's struggling with a paternal relationship. And someone made the point that there's not actually many films that do the opposite. There's certainly not many films that explore properly the relationship between a mother and son on that scale. I think that's true. But also father and daughters are very short served in big blockbuster cinema, at least in terms of an intelligent relationship. And I'm kind of curious. I was going to put that question to you before you started answering. I appreciate it. It's your podcast, you know. But how rare is that kind of relationship in your experience, and how legitimate is it? How well does it work?
As in father and daughter relationships on screen?
I'm
trying to think of another example where it's something I really like see.
It's tricky, isn't it?
The only one I can think of, which is really strange, is in Endgame, Iron Man and his daughter.
Okay.
Part of the reason why he
doesn't want to.
You're such a nerd. I know. Because obviously, part of the reason Tony doesn't want to, you know, join the fight is because he's got a kid now. But
yeah,
this is one of the things I find most admirable about Interstellar, is that, you know, it is all about love, and it's all about, like, the whole thing's driven by Cooper's love for Murph, which I felt bad for his other kid, you know, Timothy Chalamet. Kind of just a bit of a dick.
I don't like you. He's the bastard child there,
bastard
isn't he?
Child.
Yeah,
but
okay.
Like Anne Hathaway's brand has this thing where she says, you know, about Edmonds, and she's drawn to Edmonds' planet because of love, and she's like, love's the one thing, you know, we're capable of perceiving that transcends all of these dimensions of time and space. And then at the end, obviously, Matthew McConaughey realizes that, and that's what he uses to get his message to Murph. And the biggest thing I most admire about Interstellar is you got all this stuff going on, but really it's just about a dad's love for his daughter, which is, I feel like, a similar way in Inception, because, you know, the only reason why Cobb goes on his missions to get back to his kids.
Yeah.
And again, there's a lot going on, but that is the heart of the story. So I think Nolan just has this thing about it.
And then you see something like Extraction, the Netflix film.
I haven't seen that yet.
I'm going incredibly spoiler light, but it just feels like in a film like that, the father-child relationship is so bludgeoned in just to kind of give it some kind of artificial depth. That one didn't really land for me an awful lot. 99 million people have watched it, according to statistics that came out. So what do I know?
Not me. I haven't watched it.
No. What about Ang Lee? Why can't you do Take a Chance on Ang Lee? Can you do that?
Maybe.
No, you don't like that one. Edgar Wright, The Edgar Takes It All.
I like that one. But we also had Fincher Takes It All. I think I prefer Fincher
I've ruined it. You're too young for The Kids from Fame, right? Kids from Fame.
Yeah?
Excellent. Yeah, of course you are. I'm very old. I used to watch that religiously. And the best song in The Kids from Fame was Star Maker. This isn't going quite where you thought this podcast would, but I did think, if ever you're going to do a podcast about Richard Linklater, I use a stop
Star
that
Maker.
Sentence. Yeah. Look up the song. You'll understand that it's actually quite genius that I've just offered. I'll get my own coat.
Talking about music, let's talk about the Interstellar score, because...
Oh, you are a pro. You are a pro.
Because, like, I forgot how good that score is until I rewatched it recently, because... It just, if Hans Zimmer tells you to feel something, you really do feel it. And also the use of sound, I think, is really effective. Like, one of my favourite scenes, which is a really boring scene, probably to everyone else, but I really like it, is, you know, we've had takeoff, they're in space, and there's just no music at all. The only sounds you hear is off the spaceship, and obviously the characters talking. And I think it's so effective. And, you know, we've left Earth, we've left the hustle and bustle of Earth, and we're now in the emptiness of space.
Yeah.
And I don't know why it's so effective on me. It just is. But I think it's such a clever use of music. But the whole, as you mentioned earlier, with Hans Zimmer on the water planet with the beats, like, he is, like, there's so much more about the music than it just being like a score.
It goes back to Inception, doesn't it? That was the one where the relationship between Nolan and Zimmer really changed.
Because
it was James Newton Howard, wasn't it, who was doing half of the Batman stuff.
Yeah, and it was a collaboration.
And with Inception, I just felt Zimmer found the tone of it. I will say, I don't think the Interstellar score works that well away from the movie.
Why I forgot how good it was, because it's one I listen to when I'm not watching it.
Whereas the Inception score works brilliantly away from the movie. And I kind of have a love-hate with Hans Zimmer, with Hans Zimmer music, because some of it you just feel he's just like pulled a few samples out of his endless collection. And he's an incredibly talented man. Sometimes he just goes mad on drums. I remember when a brilliant writer, Ivan Radford, noticed when he was hired to do, was it Batman versus Superman, after he'd done Man of Steel? And he just put out a tweet saying, oh, Hans Zimmer celebrates his news by buying 500 new drums. And just like, basically that.
It's heavy on a timpani.
But with Interstellar, I think the story's been pretty well told, hasn't it? He was integral to it from the start. Nolan gave him the autonomy to go off and find the sound of this so that it could be woven in. And it's worth noting how unusual that is, that you hear Kenneth Branagh talking about Patrick Doyle will come to the set of a film just to get a feel for it. But conversely, look at what Zimmer's doing now. He's done the score for No Time to Die, but he wasn't on set. He had 30 days to turn that score around because he was a late replacement.
Yes,
and so to get that level of luxury where a composer, a hugely talented composer, is involved at the start, it's incredibly rare. Yeah. And I think that goes to the heart of just how well woven into the film the score is. But I agree with you also that it's the choice of silences that's pivotal. It's when Hans Zimmer shuts up. That's terrible, is it? But sometimes when
it's
they
on
just
purpose,
stop.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. I mean, the level of control is incredible. But I'm a huge fan of Brian Blessed and listening to Brian Blessed tell stories.
Yes, with his big booming voice.
Yeah, but the great myth of Brian Blessed is his storytelling is very intimate. That for 10 minutes he will boom at you. And if you go and look at Richard Herring, did a podcast with him. Richard Herring's excellent Leicester Square Theatre podcast, and he did an interview with Brian Blessed, and Blessed talks about space travel and stuff in there. I think you'd really like it. He comes on all boom, 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 as you would expect Blessed to do. Yeah. And as he goes on, he just goes quieter and quieter and quieter, and the storytelling is incredibly intimate. And he's got, and I just, whenever I hear Blessed speak for more than 10 minutes, I think that's the crucial thing, I'm very aware of the absolute level of control he's got over what he's doing. He knows exactly to the beat what he's doing. And I feel that this is a parallel I wasn't expecting to draw, but damn it, I'm committed to this. I'm going to follow through, right? I feel that with Interstellar, the absolute level of precision over the sound, and it goes beyond just what Zimmer's done. It goes beyond the silences. It goes right to the sound effect editing. It's incredible. Incredible. Sometimes I wish it was loud. I also think it's worth not quite so loud, but I also think it's worth pointing out this is the first Nolan film in a run of a few where I could hear every character's dialogue. And that genuinely hadn't, that's not me being piddly, but that hadn't happened for a few films. You know, Ken Watanabe in Inception, he's quite muffled. Obviously, there's Tom Hardy in The Dark Knight Rises, and there's a little bit of muffliness in The Dark Knight as well. And I remember writing some stuff about that, and then some stuff comes back about, no, it's all deliberate. But this one was the first one where I could hear every character speak.
And obviously, the loud, loud score, as we said, is big and loud.
It is loud, especially if you went to see it in Bradford. At that,
I know.
I mean, the sound system in that, I mean, crikey, your head must be... I mean, nothing... I don't know who you've got talking about Dunkirk.
Got Clarice on, Clarice Lockery for Dunkirk.
Well, you get the experts in for that one. She's brilliant.
Also, she's very cold on Nolan. So
interesting.
When I messaged her saying, would you like to come on, she was like, the only one she really likes.
Interesting.
Dunkirk
is the loudest film I've ever heard in a cinema. And I saw it twice in two different rooms. And in both cases, it was floor rocking. I remember going to watch Boyhood once. And that came on, that came out around the same time as one of Michael Bay's incessant Transformers sequels. And the only thing I can relate to watching Dunkirk is watching Boyhood in the screen next to a Transformers sequel and feeling the rattle come through the but with Dunkirk, I mean, I thought the ceiling was going to come in. And I think Interstellar is a stepping stone to that. I'm fascinated what Clarice has to say about it all.
The Dunkirk one should be good.
Well, can I ask you a question?
Go on.
Because you sent some notes, I'm not wishing to pull back the curtain a little bit too much, but you sent some notes through about the kind of, about your reaction to it. Because I think the whole thrust of this podcast is your love of Christopher Nolan films.
Yes, it is, yeah.
Yeah, well, clearly, But you said basically we'll have a natter about Interstellar and discuss how I'm a blubbering mess for all of it.
Yeah.
And you've talked about your response to the end of the film and how that really got you in the gut. But you also hinted that you found the emotion of it started very early through.
Yes.
I just wonder if you could talk to that a bit.
It wasn't on my first watch. I start crying on my first watch when obviously it's a loss of time and then it sort of continues on from there. But for some reason, when I rewatched it on Wednesday, I was already crying when very early on, you know, they have the drone that comes down. Cooper is showing Merv how to work the drone. I think it's just because I know what happens, I'm crying.
Yeah.
It's like how in before, like, you know, the portal scene, Endgame. Like, I'm already crying because I know what's
such
coming.
Such a nerd.
Which is good.
Yeah.
So, Yeah, but I'm just a big cry at movies, I think, to be honest, in general. But yeah, I just find like the whole portrayal of that father-daughter relationship, I don't know, it just gets to me.
So where does this film sit? I'm loathe to head towards any kind of ranking or anything like that. I'm not a massive fan of those. I'm just curious where this film sits for you in his canon of work, because it sounds like this one's really quite special to you.
Yeah, it's high up. I think it's on the same, like, nothing beats The Dark Knight for me, but The Dark Knight's what got me into cinema. That was the first film I was like, wow, at.
You are so young. Oh,
not that young. I was like 13 when I saw Dark Knight.
Well, I was 14 when I saw Tim Burton's Batman. So, you know.
Okay.
Oh, right. There's
I was trying to figure out the year.
There's an interstellar silence for you. Did you hear that? You just went full Nolan with the... there's something I could say to him about this, but let's just have a moment of silence to acknowledge how old he is.
But my personal favourite Nolans are Dark Knight, Inception and Interstellar. Oh, Memento. I think Memento is his best work.
Which one doesn't work for you?
They all work for me, Simon. That's the problem.
Okay. No, that's not a problem. That's brilliant. The one that absolutely blew me away, and the one that really, really, I was just like, what the hell is this, was Batman Begins. And that remains my favourite of his Dark Knight trilogy.
That's interesting.
Because I had no idea what I was going to get. And I don't think objectively, if you look at it, it's the best of the three films. I think The Dark Knight is the best of the three films. But for me, the one that blew me away was Batman Begins, because it's really hard to quantify if you hadn't gone through and sat through, because I hated Batman Forever. That was that for me was the one that
I haven't even seen Batman Forever, because I've just heard dire things.
Yeah, and lots of people love it, so I'm not looking to punch down on it or anything like that. It's just that was the what I'd loved what Tim Burton had done. I think those Batman films were quite flawed, but I love them anyway. I love Batman: Mask of the Phantasm. I remember really looking forward to seeing Batman Forever, and just it felt like a trap door coming from. And I sat in a room with loads of other people liking it, so fair enough. But I disliked it more than Batman and Robin. And I went to see Batman and Robin. I just wasn't surprised. But having sat through those, and this was at a point where I wasn't writing about film, and when they announced another Batman film, I was just like, I'm just not going to get my hopes up. And I didn't go to see it till about a week after it came out. And I had no idea what I was getting. It was one of my, I hadn't watched a trailer or anything like that. And it was just such a holy shit moment. And the bit where he then pulled the playing card out at the end. I mean, I knew nothing going in, nothing. I just wanted to give them all their word processor. Just go and write it now. Reminded me of the end of Doctor Who series 3 of the revival, the episode Utopia, where the Derek Jacobi revelation happened.
Ah, one yes, of those, yeah.
Jumping up and down on but that was the one for me. That was the one. I think that probably always been my favorite for that reason. I thought the impact of what this man could do with a film, with treating the audience as if they're intelligent, to do it on a canvas that big. You only have to look at the cinema schedules the last 5 years to see how rare that is. Who else is treating audiences at this scale with just that level of respect and intelligence, and not dumbing down at any point, for better or worse? I certainly felt dumb at first at the end of Interstellar, but for better or worse.
Yeah, that's what I found most remarkable. As you said very early on, is Interstellar was promoted as this big sci-fi epic to the general audience, and it's interesting. Obviously, there's quite a few people just like it, but it's so interesting how, you know, if you look at the box office and like how successful it was, you know, people love this movie.
It's huge, wasn't it? I'm not even necessarily sure that they love it. I couldn't say that with any great, but I think they went to see it.
Yes, they and definitely went to see it.
What, 800, 900 million worldwide?
It's a lot. It did
huge numbers. And every time a film of this ambition and scale does that kind of number, it just slightly, just so minutely perhaps, just greases the wheel slightly for someone else being able to get something off the ground. I mean, I would imagine when Arrival was being pitched, Nolan's name came into the pitch to try and get the money. You know, you can say Ad Astra again, Anytime anyone is going to try and make an intelligent sci-fi film and they come up against some stereotypical Hollywood executive who's tapping away at their Excel spreadsheet, it's bound to be a man. And just no one will go and watch that. No one. It's just like, look what Nolan did. Mm-hmm. And that is the trail that he's blazed, whether you like his film or not, that he's made. He's not just made these films. They're monster hits.
Yep.
They're monster. What was the last one that wasn't a monster? Was it The Prestige? And even that was profitable. He's not had a flop movie.
No.
And it's crucial that he doesn't. I mean, Tenet, I understand why they're being so cautious about just when they release this, because we can't afford a Christopher Nolan film to fail.
I was going to ask you about whether you're excited to see Tenet without getting into all the politics of it. You know, whenever it's released safely, are you looking forward to seeing it?
Yeah, of course. And I've not watched a single frame of any of the footage that's been released from it. Nothing.
Trailers?
No. I don't watch trailers. Don't watch trailers.
I was about to ask you, because we've had a few people on the podcast who say that they actively avoid not trailers in general, but Christopher Nolan trailers, which is interesting because I find that, obviously I'm being the nerd I am, like I went to go see Rise of Skywalker again in IMAX so I can watch the prologue that was attached to it for Tenet. But I like it because I think the trailers are very misleading in terms of all Nolan movies. Like
They throw you off.
So I don't really like find it an issue in terms of watching the trailers. But a lot of people have this thing where they don't watch Nolan trailers. But you don't watch any trailers.
No, not if I can help it. I mean, it's quite challenging because every day I put trailer posts on the internet, but I don't watch.
Yeah.
If you ever read the articles I write about trailers, I don't do trailer breakdowns or anything like that. And the reason is I don't watch trailers. And as a consequence of that, every time I'm seeing a film, and so occasionally one slips through, I mean, you know, but every time I'm seeing a film, I'm having zero of it spoiled in advance. And I've got to tell you, it is bliss. It was a guy called Ali Gray who put me onto this, does the website The Shiznit. And he did a great big challenge to try and watch Man of Steel all those years ago without watching a trailer first. And he just about did it. I just thought that's interesting. And actually, it's not that tricky to avoid trailers. No, if you don't want to watch them,
you just stop playing, or you just look away.
You just don't. Yeah, you just look away. And I am that idiot in the cinema back when we were allowed in such places who covers their eyes or puts their fingers in their ears. And so I have zero idea, and I'm not saying I'd have a great idea if I'd watched it, outside of the cast, what Tenet is about. I could tell you it's 149 minutes and 59 seconds.
Ah,
so I wrote that story, you know, but that's all right. You know, you've got to plan when you go for a wee. But that's it. So, yes, I am hugely looking forward to the film. I'd be surprised if we see it this side of October, but
yeah.
Be a pleasant surprise, but I couldn't tell you a thing about it,
which is good. I think I personally, one of the reasons I think I also love Nolan films is I like to go in, even though I've seen, unlike you, I watch the trailers, I still don't know what the hell is going to happen and what to expect. Like we keep going back to the ending of Interstellar, you know, the last half an hour, which is the bookcases, incredibly surreal. Like no one saw that coming. Like if you tell me you saw that coming, you are a liar.
Yeah, well, no one saw it coming because it needs 4,000 words to explain it. I do think there's a correlation to that, and I understand. Again, I understand the choice that was made to do that, and it is the thing that you watch it again and again, and it makes more sense. But I do think there was also, for all the clues that I've talked about that he seeded through, there was still a reason nobody saw that coming. You know, the breadcrumbs that were being laid, you would still have to do some pretty dramatic jumps to think, oh, it's going to end up in a five-dimensional library and he's zipping around talking to someone like decades before and shoveling some dust around and stuff. So Emily, I confess to you, I didn't see that coming. And every time I've guessed at a subsequent ending along those lines in a film, I've been wild.
Yeah, it's the sheer bravery, I think, that I admire.
It is the penitent man will pass, isn't it? It is such a leap. Is it too big a leap? I couldn't tell you, but it is a leap.
I think Interstellar is going to be, I think, even more so than Inception, it's still going to be puzzling us for many, many years to come in a good way. That's why I like my films to demand stuff off me. Not all the time. Sometimes I just want to watch Pitch Perfect probably about once every week.
See, I have problems with that. I have problems with Pitch Perfect. So I really wish I liked that. This has gone off in a slightly
Yeah,
different.
Yeah.
I, as someone who's continually struggled with weight, I really think I think there's a kind of cruelty to Rebel Wilson's character right throughout those films, and I don't like it, and it really makes me feel a bit sour, really. And there's a film that came out, again, this isn't one that I was expecting to talk about. There's a film that came out called Florence Foster Jenkins a few years ago, hugely acclaimed. Meryl Streep, brilliant in it. Hugh Grant, brilliant in
it. Yeah, I think I missed that one.
Yeah, and, you know, talk of Oscar nominations. I think it got Oscar nominations as well. I really didn't like it. And I just felt it was encouraging me to laugh at someone, not with them. And I really struggle. I'm really sensitive to that. And I really struggled with Florence Foster Jenkins because of that, because I just felt it was making fun of someone. And that's my fundamental problem, that even though I see Rebel Wilson's in on the joke with the Pitch Perfect films, one of my coping mechanisms at school when I was being bullied over my weight was I basically metaphorically punched myself and joined in with it. And what I see, what I get from the Pitch Perfect films is that's just what's going on, that the way she's dealing with it is basically a coping mechanism of joining in with the bullies over her way. So that's why I'm not a huge fan of Pitch Perfect. Did you ask me that question?
No, but that was a good answer. I think my point was that, like, one of the things I love about Nolan's movies is that it demands a lot off you. Like, I have to be in a mood.
Yes.
For Interstellar, and
you have to be on your game to watch a Nolan film.
It got to like 9:15 on Wednesday. I left Wednesday night free. I purposely left Wednesday night free, but obviously work is work, it's busy. And I was like, oh, I gotta watch Interstellar now. I was like, I'm too tired for this. But as soon as it started, it just it hooked me, and it was great. But I don't need all my films to be as demanding as Interstellar, but we need more of it.
Is there a Nolan film you just sit and watch for fun? That you don't feel you need your brain to be in that place?
Maybe the Batman movies, but
yeah.
As in, they're out of all of them, they're the ones you can probably switch off a bit during it for fun.
Yeah, okay.
But I personally would never do that.
they would feel disrespectful and criminal to do that. I understand.
I like to give it my full attention, and it's actually been a while since I've watched like his movies. I think just because I dedicate so much of my time now as well to watching the constant new releases, even if they have been lacking during quarantine.
I was going to say, there's been barrels of those, haven't there?
Yeah, which has been why it's a good time to rewatch all Christopher Nolan's movies, because they are like a lot, and like Interstellar will just leave me crying for like a good hour after, but also leave me thinking for a good several hours after, which is,
and then sending strange people from the Midlands long notes about all the things that you're going to talk about. I get that.
Yeah, which is, as I said, highlight was mostly just why I'm such a blubbery mess during it. I just find this whole conversation, like, because it's something that we keep going back to the podcast, it's been interesting getting all the guests' opinions on it, of Nolan as a cold filmmaker. Like, I just can't wrap my head around why people think that, especially when it comes to Interstellar. Because even though there's loads of hard science, it is just a dad wanting to save the world for his kids.
Yeah, but it is a lot of hard science.
But there's a lot.
I get why people feel this one's cold. I don't agree with it, but I completely get why. For all that core relationship at the heart of it, it makes you work for it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm interested in terms of, you know, you asked me earlier about how, not a ranking, but how it sort of compares to other Nolan works. For you, is it one of your favourites? Obviously, you mentioned Batman Begins for you, it's the one that wows you, but in terms of Interstellar?
I don't know, because, I go back, the second viewing is key. I think Batman Begins is what is my one of choice. Dunkirk would be high up the list, primarily because it's under 2 hours as well.
Is it 90? No, it's not 90 minutes.
107 minutes, I think, including credits, though, and there's a lot of credits. So I wouldn't have been watching the film had you not kindly invited me to ruin your podcast for you. So I don't think I ever would pick it off the shelf for a fun night in. Is it? I couldn't tell you. I mean, I've never really tried to rank them, but I'm keen to give you some kind of answer. Inception got better because I struggled with that a bit at first.
Did
as well.
You? Okay. Because that's probably his most popular one.
Yeah, that took me two runs. That took me two runs. But the second run, a lot better. And so I think that's high up. Now, I'd need to go back and look at a few. For the purposes of your question, so that okay. it doesn't look like I'm completely putting splinters up my backside, I would go Batman Begins. But yeah. just the sheer impact of that film on me when I first saw it was, yeah, that one's a special one.
Yeah, yeah. Batman Begins is great, to be fair.
Hooray! Have Hooray. I passed the test?
Everyone passes the test.
Oh, thank goodness for that, because you did pick the really clever film and invited the dimmest person on to talk about it.
No, I think I picked a perfect guest to talk about Interstellar. And also, you got your Kevin Costner and Geostorm references in. So,
I think we remarkable. Said pitch perfect. What we talked about anything but Interstellar. It's been quite the podcast.
It has been quite the podcast. So thank you for coming on.
Absolute pleasure.
I suppose the last question, Simon, is where can we find more of your work?
Why would you want any more after what you just had to sit through? You can find all the films. There's loads of film stories bits at www.filmstories.co.uk. And I'm on Twitter warbling on and trying to avoid doing PE at Simon Brew.
Oh, PE with Joe Wicks. Yeah. I lasted a week, so you've done much better than me.
Let's not go there. It's been a very dark few months, Emily. A very dark few months.
It's not over yet.
I'm off for a cry now for different reasons to you.
Yeah, I'm off for a cry at Interstellar again because it still bloody hits me hard. I don't even know why. It just does. Well, thank you very much for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
That's a pleasure's mine. Take care.
That was me and Simon Brew discussing all things Interstellar. In the next episode, I will be joined by journalist and film critic Clarice Lockley to just chat about Nolan's war movie, Dunkirk. Don't forget to subscribe, follow us on Twitter at NolanMeNolanYou, and feel free to get in touch too with any feedback. See you next week!